All right, looks like awesome. So here, are we good on that, Lisa?
That's
good. Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. Our next paper is from Jonathan Perry of Stockholm University. Excellent paper, Consent, Justification of Defensive Harm. Love the paper. I love that it had an elevator example.
You know, wearing the t-shirt. That was the whole point.
It's hidden. It's underneath. Our respondent today is Michael Robillard from the University of Connecticut. Michael, you've got 30 minutes.
All right, great. Thanks. So today I'll be responding to Jonathan's paper, and I'm very honored to do so. In his paper, Perry focuses on the role that consent plays with respect to the permissibility of defending groups of victims from unjust attack. Contrary to cases involving individuals where consent or refusal of defensive assistance is necessarily univocal, cases involving other defense involving groups oftentimes is anything but. Accordingly, many skeptics have endorsed the view that consent is nearly irrelevant to the permissibility of other defense. Responding to this skeptical view, Perry offers a more robust and expansive account of the role that consent plays with respect to the permissibility of defensive harming on behalf of others. Perry begins by considering two common formulations of the consent requirements, the majority consent requirement and the minimal consent requirement. The majority consent requirement states that in order for defending a group of victims to be morally justified, the majority or supermajority of members of the victim group must consent to defensive assistance or not explicitly and confidently refuse. Perry quickly points out why the majority consent requirement won't work, and he does so primarily by his Elevator 2 case. So if you recall, this involves the five victims in the elevator. Aggressor is sawing the elevator cable. Defender can kill aggressor on behalf of the five with her sniper rifle, but four of the members within the victim group refuse, while one consents to defensive assistance. So in this case, we have a clear instance where there's an absence of a majority of consenting agents to third-party intervention, yet for most of us, we'll think that it's the intuitive findings will be that it would still be permissible for defender to intervene on behalf of just the one consenting agent. So given this intuition, Perry argues that many consent skeptics will then say that we're moved to adopt instead the minimal consent requirement. And the minimal consent requirement states that in order for defending others to be morally justified, some members of the victim group must consent to defensive assistance or not explicitly and competently refuse. According to Perry, the skeptic's claim is that victim consent imposes an extremely trivial independent constraint on defense in multiple victim cases. While Perry concedes that the consent requirement is in fact practically irrelevant for the specific cases that consent skeptics have outlined, he contends that there are indeed many more relevant cases involving group consent that we must consider, especially those involving significant collateral harm. And this is where he introduces his Elevator 3 case. And this is pretty much structurally similar to Elevator 2. We still have the five in the elevator. Four are refusing consent. One gives consent or authorization to defender. This time, however, defender, rather than having a sniper rifle, defender has a grenade that she can throw and kill aggressor, but standing next to aggressor is bystander. Now, in this case, Jonathan argues that it's particularly problematic for the consent skeptic, since the minimal consent requirement is technically met. Some of the victims, at least one of them, does consent. However, it does seem impermissible for defender to kill bystander in an effort to save the five victims. The reason behind this, Jonathan suggests, is that the goods of the four refusing victims can no longer be factored into our proportionality calculus, thereby turning this effectively into a one-for-one trade-off of is it permissible to kill one bystander in order to save one victim. Most of us will think that is a radically insufficient threshold to justify such collateral harm. Perry suggests that a way of determining whether the consent requirement has been met in a particular case would be for us to apply the following counterfactual test. He states, if refusing members of a victim group did not exist, would defending the remaining members be permissible, holding all else equal? If the answer is no, the consent requirement has not been met and defense is impermissible. Perry thereby argues that we are moved to adopt what he calls the proportionate consent requirement instead. So the proportionate consent requirement states that in order for defending or others to be morally permissible, a sufficient subset of members of the victim group must consent to defensive assistance or must not competently and explicitly refuse. And the subset is sufficient if the benefits of defense to the members of the subset are sufficient to justify the total amount of harm that defending the group will cause. And I think there are several objections that one can raise to Perry's view. First of all, while I agree with Jonathan's conclusion that it would indeed be impermissible for a rescuer to intervene in the case of Elevator 3, I don't think that this case actually shows that the minimal consent requirement is false, as Perry suggests. He writes, in cases where, unlike Elevator 1 and 2, the number of victims matters because defense involves causing significant collateral harm, the moral unavailability of these reasons may render defensive force disproportionate depending on the facts of the case. If correct, this shows that the skeptic's aggregation principle, the minimal consent requirement, is false. I think, however, Perry's use of the word false is just too strong of a description here, since in order for a sufficient subset of the members of the victim group to consent to defensive assistance, as stated in his proportionate consent requirement, it must necessarily be the case that some or at least one of the members of the victim group consents as well. That is, at least for all cases that we think sufficiency demands at least one consenting member, as will almost always be the case. So I think false is just too strong of a claim. Rather, I think Jonathan might want to say that the minimal consent requirement is incomplete, or it's necessary but not sufficient, since, like I said, the minimal consent requirement, it just will be contained within the proportionate consent requirement in all cases where sufficiency requires that at least one victim consents. What I think Jonathan is onto, though, is this difference between some and sufficient, where some merely references a feature of set membership internal to the set of victims itself, sufficiency gestures to features external to merely the set of victims. Bearing this in mind, permissibility for intervention, it seems, cannot hinge on only the fact that some members of the victim group consent. To see this, consider the relevant difference between these two claims. If some of the poison gets into the glass and you drink it, then you will die, versus if a sufficient amount of the poison gets into the glass and you drink it, then you'll die. Regarding the first claim, it seems that we can definitively say whether or not you will die simply by checking the glass of water itself and nothing else in order to see if any of the poison is contained within that set. Regarding the second claim, however, it isn't enough that we simply check the glass of water for the presence of some poison. Indeed, there are other relevant questions that we need to answer that go beyond just the question of whether or not the set of the glass contains some of the poison. Rather, we must also consider other relevant external features, namely those pertaining to you. What is your age? What is your body weight? What is your fitness level? What is your history of recreational poison drinking? So sufficiency, we can understand this as a relational property that reaches beyond just set membership, as is the case in a simple understanding of the word sum. And I think that's the real advantage of Jonathan's proportionate consent requirement. But to be clear, even if this understanding of sufficiency is better in capturing what's going on in intervention cases like Elevator 3, satisfaction of this sufficiency condition will nonetheless entail that at least some members of the victim group consent to intervention in almost all cases. In this sense, the minimal consent requirement is not false, it's just incomplete. As a second rather minor criticism of Perry's view, I can imagine some philosophers also taking issue with the underspecification of the term defensive assistance. In the same way that Perry argues that justification for intervention cannot ride on the simple notion of sum, I argue that justification for intervention cannot simply ride on a simple notion of defensive assistance. In other words, I don't think that it makes coherent sense for us to talk of somebody consenting to defensive assistance supplicator, as is stated in Perry's proportionate consent requirement. To see this, consider the following case. Victim is sunning herself at the beach when aggressor, who is much bigger and stronger than victim, begins vigorously kicking sand in her face. Seeing this, bodyguard asks victim if she would like him to use defensive assistance on her behalf in order to get aggressor to stop. Victim consents to bodyguard's offer of defensive assistance, and bodyguard proceeds to violently bludgeon aggressor to death with a portable beach cooler. As we see in this case, victim does technically consent to defensive assistance as per Perry's stipulated criteria for justification. However, defensive assistance is substantially underspecified. Indeed, we can certainly imagine victims' horrified reaction to all of this. Yes, I consented to you defending me, but not like that. This case seems to show that Perry's proportionate consent requirement, while still, I think, true, is in need of further sharpening the specification, specifically when it comes to the degree of defensive harm that the victim is or is not consenting to. So what I suggest is that we just add in a stipulation within the proportionate consent requirement. It's called proportionate consent requirement star, that would state, in order for defending others to be morally permissible, a sufficient subset of the members of the victim group must consent to proportionate defensive assistance. And defensive assistance is proportionate if the resulting harm is equal to or less than the unjust harm that it aims to thwart. Later in his paper, Perry considers the question of when and if there are ever cases where it would be morally required of victims to consent to aid. This is where it, of course, comes up whenever we consider cases where a single victim's refusal of aid will have significant bad consequences for other potential victims. So, for example, in Elevator 3, one might think that the refusal of just a single victim could render it impermissible for a defender to defend the other four consenting victims in the elevator. By reducing the overall set of justificatory reasons available to defender to below the threshold at which she would be have a lesser evil justification for collaterally killing bystander. Considering such a case, an opponent of Perry could argue that the single non-consenting victim would be acting wrongly by refusing defensive assistance. According to David Eslin, the fact that it would be morally wrong for the victim to refuse aid means that their non-consent would be invalid. Hence, the reluctant victim's good would be morally available to rescuer, and therefore enough to weigh in favor of him defending the group of five, even if it meant collaterally killing the bystander. While Perry notes the plausibility of such a view, he ultimately argues that it's false, since the reasoning behind such a view follows from a confusion over our duty to make available to others our material resources versus what he calls our moral resources. He argues that if one can bring it about that others will be saved from harm by making their good morally available as a justificatory resource, then he sees no reason why they would do so. Hence, it would seem that there are no grounds for invalidating our refusal of aid. Perry motivates this position by asking us to consider two cases, Trolley and Trolley 2. So in Trolley, we have four on the main track, bystander, or one on the side track, and Barry is crossing across the main track. And he recognizes that four is an insufficient number of victims to justify the person at the switch to switch to the side track to kill the one. And Jonathan asks, would Barry have any reason to remain standing or step onto the main track to get the number up to five, such that the person at the switch would then have enough justification, or if you're Helen, then an obligation to switch the trolley to the sidetrack. And Jonathan argues that it just doesn't seem that this person has any reason to alter the balance of moral reasons that are already there to begin with. He contrasts this with Trolley 2, where we have the four on the main track, one on the sidetrack, and this time Barry can shove the person on the sidetrack and remove them as both a physical and a moral obstacle to the person at the switch, therefore giving them an avenue to divert the trolley without harming anybody. So in this case, it does seem that Barry would be under an obligation to not contribute his own moral resources, but to remove more barriers in the particular situation. Now, I generally agree with Jonathan's point in a case like Trolley, that Barry has no additional moral reasons compelling him to alter the already existing balance of moral reasons. I can't, however, imagine a specific case where it's at least plausible that one would, in fact, be under an obligation to consent to aid for the sake of others, and indeed an obligation to make that consent publicly known. This would be in an instance where the agent finds herself in a position where she has good reason to believe that other victims around her conditionally consent to aid from third parties, but have not yet explicitly consented for some reason. What I have in mind here is a problem specifically addressed by Alan Buchanan in The Ethics of Revolution and its implications for the ethics of intervention. Here, Buchanan notes that oftentimes the structural features of the revolutionary situation will make it extremely difficult or impossible for revolutionaries to satisfy the usad bellum requirement of reasonable likelihood of success. This is so precisely because most revolutionary efforts will, in the beginning, be lacking a critical mass of fully consenting agents. Rather, the situation for most citizens standing on the sideline as the revolution gets underway will be one of conditional consent. That is, consent to the idea that of the revolution taking place, but only on the condition that it actually has a chance of succeeding. Ironically, such a critical mass of consenting citizens will often be the necessary condition that needs to be met in order for the revolution to succeed. Thus, an odd paralyzing sort of stalemate occurs where the vast majority of citizens conditionally consent to the revolution, though no one wants to be the first one to actually stick their neck out to signal actual consent. And I think a similar problem we could imagine with respect to third-party interventions. So imagine a case where aggressor quietly holds five victims under gunpoint. Police officer casually strolls by the five victims, totally unaware of the threat that they are presently under. One of the victims is a pacifist who does not consent to the idea of a police officer using violence to save him. However, he suspects that the other four victims do in fact consent to such intervention, though they remain silent out of fear of being shot by aggressor. Let us also stipulate that the threat of getting fatally shot is significantly less for pacifists than it is for the other four victims. Now the question that I would ask here is, should pacifists signal consent to violent intervention on the part of a police officer? And here I think that he should, that he is under such an obligation, since his signaling of consent would effectively serve as a surrogate for the other four who want to consent but just can't. And I think that this arguably could be a case where the person would be obligated to consent for the sake of others. As a last point, Perry concludes by relating these findings regarding victim consent to the question of public protest. Here, Perry considers not just the expressive power of protest, but also the power of protest to be morally transformative. Public protest, according to Perry, can be morally transformative when a protester's act may be interpreted as not simply expressing an attitude, but also exercising a normative power, the power to withhold their consent to the action or policy being protested. On this view, Perry argues that the existence of protest may itself serve to make it the case that the specific benefits garnered by the protesters as a result of the policy in question could no longer be appealed to justify that particular policy. This would then have the effect of diminishing the overall set of reasons policymakers could legitimately appeal to. As Perry notes, this is perhaps most clearly exemplified by the "Not My Name" signs brandished by protesters during protests of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Now, I'm not sure exactly what to make of such cases. Clearly, something about Jonathan's claim is correct. If I can withdraw my particular set of moral resources from the pot of reasons that rescuer can legitimately draw from to justify harming aggressor and bystander in Elevator 3, then it seems I ought to be able to do something very similar in cases that are just on a much larger scale, like a protest of a particular policy. However, in comparing these two cases, I think the public nature of language seems to factor in much more strongly in cases like a protest of the Iraq War than in a case like Elevator 3. In fact, I've always thought it somewhat very peculiar about the notion of a person holding up a sign that says no to Policy 5, but then going on to do other expressive and non-expressive activities, such as paying taxes, contributing to the economy, voting, and reaping benefits, that seem very much do function to support and reinforce Policy 5, and considerably more so. While I agree with Perry that in principle the very act of protesting could be morally transformative, I think the vast majority of the time this transformative power will be silenced, since most protesters will continue doing these other weightier expressive and non-expressive acts as a simple function of remaining members of society. This will therefore largely cancel out whatever transformative power there exists in a few dozen or even a few hundred hours of sign-holding. There therefore appears to be something very important about the publicity requirement of language with respect to an agent's consent that is going on in such protest cases, and that is absent in cases like Elevator 3. Like Humpty Dumpty explaining to Alice, "When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." The protester's act of signaling that he or she is opting out when it comes to a specific policy may not actually carry nearly the transformative power that she wants or intends it to have, any more than Humpty Dumpty's personal intent can change the meaning of words. Even if these agents are both fully sincere in their intent, it seems that language and meaning simply doesn't function that way. Thus, one can say they are opting out as much as they like, but so as long as they continue performing these other expressive and non-expressive acts mentioned, it turns out that, by and large, they haven't. Hence, I think Perry is correct that the protests can have this transformative power in principle, but I'm somewhat skeptical of what the force of that transformative power really amounts to in real-world cases. That's all I got.
All right. Excellent. Jonathan, great. You have response.
Sure. Thanks very much, Mike. That's really, really helpful. So I've got some responses, and I think they're in descending order of clarity and strength. So I'll start with the ones where I'm pretty sure I'm right, and then we'll go on from there. So I do think the minimal consent requirement is false, and it's false if my view is, if the, what's my view called? Proportionate consent requirement. If the proportionate consent requirement is true. So I think, I mean, it's certainly true that there are going to be cases in which, it's certainly true, you're right, that it's a condition of having sufficient consent that some consent. So yeah, that's definitely true. But it's not true that this means... And because that's true, there are going to be cases in which both the minimal consent requirement and the proportionate consent requirement are going to give the same verdict in cases. So in case two, both views, say, give the same result. It's permissible. But that doesn't mean that, I think... we shouldn't conclude from that the minimal consent requirement is kind of a part of the proportionate consent requirement, or that it's... the proportionate consent requirement is just fleshing out more of the minimal consent requirement, because they are they're both general claims, and I mean, just the truth of the proportionate consent requirement entails the falsity of the minimal consent requirement. Because just the minimal consent requirement is just going to say, it says as a general matter, in these cases, these are the conditions under which it's permissible to act, and the proportionate consent requirement, if it's true. So there are cases in which it's impermissible to act despite the fact that that condition's been met. So I think I can maintain just that these are separate, independent aggregation principles. But also, so just one more thing on that. It's true that they're both views are going to give the same results in cases like case two, but the point is that they give it for different reasons. There's a different explanation of why that's the case. What people are consenting to, question, you're right. I think you're absolutely right that, as a general matter, what you consent to is going to be, as we're getting to this. It has to be the case for your consent to be effective that you're actually consenting to the thing that the person does, right? Mm-hmm. So if you describe what you're... If, as I seem to do, you describe what you're consenting to, defensive assistance very broadly, there are going to be these cases where it's just pretty clear that's not actually what I meant, So you're right that I need to make this more precise, but I don't think I should do that by revising it in the way that you suggested, by saying I consent to proportionate defence. I think a cleaner way I think I should do it is just say, in order for a defensive act to be permissible, it must be the case that blah, 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 this many people... consent to that defensive act, or something like that, or consent to an act which is sufficiently similar to that act. Is what I mean. So I think that's the way I'd like to specify it, rather than saying I consent to proportionate defence, because I think, as you pointed out in discussion, as I said, I think it's just a bit weird that you consent to the moral status of an action. Really, is your consent determines the moral status of the action, in my view. And also, as you pointed out, you might get these slightly weird circularity questions where, because in my view, what counts as a proportionate defensive act depends on who's consented. If we start saying you consent to a proportionate act, you might get these weird sort of feedback loops going on. So that's the way I want to just precify the claim to avoid that kind of problem. I should also point out that's just a kind of a general problem with any theory of consent, whether it's groups. We just need a background theory of what is. What are the scope of actions that a person consents to by, using a certain utterance? Okay, so I like the... So these are on the kind of variations on the Barry trolley cases. So actually, is there a pen somewhere?
Yep. Yeah. So just can I just press first? So your case is something like this. You've got five victims... bear with me. You think I'd be quicker at this, wouldn't you, after?
Yeah.
So five victims and one aggressor, and there's the rescuer. Completeness. Rescuer,
A for aggressive growth.
And there's no bystanders in this case?
No.
Okay, right. And so the idea is that a rescuer just isn't aware of the presence of the victims.
Mm.
And the distribution of kind of consent and refusal defensive assistance is the same as in Elevator 2 and
yeah.
3. So one person thinks, no, I don't want to be saved, but four do.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that because rescuer is like sort of aimlessly wandering by and they're not aware, and it turns out that the one person who doesn't want to be saved can bring about the saving of the others by saying, I consent to.
Mm.
It just seems like in this case, what you're doing is, your consent is really just functioning causally rather than morally. So what's going on by your saying, I consent, is you're just alerting this person to the presence of moral reasons that are already sufficient to justify killing the aggressor, you know, independently of the person who doesn't want to be defended themselves. So it seems like the way this case gets going is it just for some reason happens to be the case that you signal by saying
right.
I consent. So, but it seems like we could show that the fact that you could just substitute the phrase I consent for hey, we need saving.
Mm.
Look what's going on.
Mm.
Hey, buddy. Shows that I think that it's not your consent per se that's doing the work. And it's just not the fact that by alerting the rescuers to the presence of the four, you wouldn't be bringing about their saving by changing the balance for moral reasons.
That's
the important
right.
point.
Yeah.
You're just doing something purely causal. It's like you're changing the causal architecture of the situation,
not right.
the moral architecture. I think we can really see this just by thinking that whatever obligations the person who doesn't want to be saved has, in this case to bring about the saving of the four, are identical with the obligations of another person who's good, who's not threatened at all, who's good, not saving. I mean, whatever obligations they have, this person has.
Right.
To our rights. So I want to say this is actually just a case of what I call an interior contribution,
right.
and those can be governed by obligations quite straightforwardly. It's not a moral contribution, even though if for some reason they have to say I consent in order to bring it about that this person is saved, will these people be saved? It's still a material contribution,
right.
so I think I can get around that kind of objection. How am I doing for time?
A couple minutes.
Okay, great. And
that was fast.
I was slow.
So there was that case, and then there was the questions about protest. Was there a case in between? No, so there's four objections, right?
Yeah,
okay, good. So the protest stuff, yeah, this is interesting. So this way, is the argument... Well, no, there's no way of putting it. It seems like what the objection is about the conditions of valid consent and refusal in these cases, right? So you're not denying my idea that when certain conditions are met, protest can be normatively transformative in the way I've claimed.
Mm.
Your question is, look, is it really true that the mere act of protest counts as valid consent or refusal?
Mm.
Sufficient in these cases,
right?
Or do you need something else? And so it certainly seems true, at least in my view, that valid refusal is going to require the intention to do so, and it's going to be in good faith.
Mm.
I mean, it has to be true that they genuinely oppose the policy.
Oh, yeah. Let's say they do that,
I mean, they're not doing it just to look cool to their friends.
No, they're committed to it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with you, it's definitely not true that every single person holding up the sign is going to have their good taken out of the pot, because there could be these people in there who are failing either the intentional or good faith conditions. But the idea that kind of, you could meet those conditions in the protest, but then in the rest of your life you seem to be doing things which undermine.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, so I've got two questions. So do you think they're failing to sort of intentionally, they're failing the intent, sorry, their behaviour in these other cases indicates that they failed to sort of intentionally refuse in the protest case? Or do you think it's more this idea that look, their pattern of behaviour just reveals bad faith in their act of refusal in the protest? Or is it, and this is the second part, or is it this more general idea that it seems to me this might be something you're saying, that whether someone validly consents or refuses, validly refuses in this case, just depends on whether, I mean, they genuinely dislike or repudiate or whatever the action that they're refusing. Mm. It seems like there's kind of parallel cases where, so here's my case which I thought might be a counterexample to this. I mean, it's difficult because there are lots of complicating factors. We might imagine, you know, the Jehovah's Witness is brought in for the blood transfusion, and they say at the time, no, I don't want it. Mm. And it seems, at least to me, clearly impermissible, and to lots of people, clearly impermissible to give them transfusion. That might be for questions of bodily integrity, which might be a disanalogy, but let's put that aside. But then it turns out we do a bit of research, we look on their Facebook posts, they're a really crappy Jehovah's Witness, they're like, you know, and they're not doing all the things that someone would do, you know, to be a good Jehovah's Witness. So they're not really, you know,
hardcore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't quite know how to describe it, but, I mean, would you have the same kind of view in this case? Because my view is just, like, what matters is that they validly consented at the time, and, you know, the fact that this, the fact this might not be as important, the fact that their refusal might not reflect as important a value in their life as we might think, doesn't alter the fact that their consent was valid, in this case, I think.
I think what I want to say is that valid consent is essentially is the totality of one's expressive and non-expressive actions. So even if I wear a t-shirt or a sign or I like something on Facebook that says no to a particular policy, but then the remainder of my actions within society causally contribute to that policy or indirectly engage in other expressive activities that seem to support or at least are complicit with that policy, then I think I'm mistaken about what it is that I think that I'm consenting to when I'm wearing that t-shirt. It turns out that maybe someone should point it out to me. You do realize everything else about the way that you're living speaks much louder than this singular expressive act. And the weight of that expressive act will largely be determined within the sort of the weight that the public grants to that particular speech act. So if it's sign holding in the rain might not carry as much moral weight, but testifying in court or speaking under oath or casting a vote, that speech act might have more moral transformative power than these ones that are sort of not as deeply embedded within social institutions. So I guess it's sort of two separate thoughts.
No. I mean, I have to think a lot more about this. It seems like there's lots of different ways you can go on this idea, right? You could think that your later actions, say, you know, paying your taxes or whatever to the war that you were there holding your sign for a few days earlier. Mm. We might not think that your later action, if we think it's a kind of, it looks, some people think those kind of actions are consent. We might think, it's not the case that your later behaviour invalidates your earlier refusal. Mm. It's the fact that you've now, at time T2, you're now consenting to the action, or something like that, right? So that might be one way of going on it. Another kind of, sorry, we're out of time. But the other kind of view, which I thought more that you were pushing on, was just this idea that your consent and refusal, the validity of consent and refusal depends just on how central the value you draw on in. Mm. Justifying your consent or refusal, how much you really value it, maybe most. And maybe that's true, and maybe one's other behaviours are just evidence about whether your earlier acts of consent or refusal was in fact valid or not, perhaps. Mm. I think there are even more ways to go on this. So.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both.
Questions and just a reminder of